Light.
Camera.
Philosophy.
Rolling out the red carpet for the second annual Philosophy Talk Dionysus Awards.
And the nominees are, for most profound riddle of existence,
A Serious Man.
The rabbi is busy.
He didn't look busy.
He's thinking.
For the most hellacious depiction of war, Hurt Locker.
What's the best way to go about disarming one of these things?
The way you don't die, sir.
For the most morally compelling portrayal of man's inhumanity to crustaceans,
District 9.
What we do here at this department is we try to engage with the prawn on behalf of humans.
It's the second annual Dionysus Awards.
Coming up on Philosophy Talk.
After the news.
Welcome to Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. We're coming to you from the studios of KALW San Francisco.
Continuing conversations that began at Philosopher's Corner on the Stanford campus.
Today, it's our second annual Dionysus Awards show. Dionysus Awards are presented to the most philosophically interesting movies of the year. And also, when we feel like it, the philosophically notable movies from the past.
Ken and I will be announcing our 2009 Dionysus Award winners later on in the show. But it's a fluid process, you know. Unlike your average award show, we're eager to accept spontaneous nominations from the floor, and we even invent new categories sometimes. So join the fun by calling 1-800-525-9917. That's 1-800-525-9917.
So, John, you know, the Dionysus Awards may not yet have achieved quite the cachet of the Oscars, but, you know, I do believe our little award is having some effect. Just look at the crop of philosophically interesting movies Hollywood produced this year. A year after we gave our first Dionysus Awards, it was a rich crop. There was District 9, A Serious Man, Up in the Air, Avatar, and that's just to name just a few. These are both good movies and philosophically rich movies. It's like that line in that movie, A Field of Dreams, if you build it, they will come.
Ken, I think you're lost in your own field of dreams. We haven't had any influence on Hollywood. But who cares? The important thing is that there are so many philosophically interesting movies to talk about this year. So let's talk about them.
Okay, so John, I'm game. So why don't we start by you telling us what the difference is between just an ordinarily a movie that's compelling as entertainment and a philosophically compelling movie?
Well, to be philosophically compelling movie, you got to be compelling. You got to be a good movie. I mean, I can imagine a film that's philosophically rich but boring as can be. That's not going to get one of our Dionysus Awards.
And I take it we also aren't particularly interested in honoring movies that, though maybe perfectly fine, maybe even great examples of filmmaking, don't have much philosophical content. I mean, take last year's Slumdog Millionaire. We both love that movie. That was a fine, fine movie, but we didn't think it deserved the Dionysus Awards.
Yeah, but you got to be careful, Ken. A movie doesn't have to be kind of explicitly making a philosophical point. Like life itself, the movies at best offer us situations, characters, events that make us think deeply about the nature of things, about the nature of love, the morality of betrayal, about hope, fear, ambition, and the like. So a movie can be philosophically compelling even without being explicitly philosophical because it compels us to think hard about human life.
I totally agree with you there, John. Totally agree. But let's not forget that there is this other way in which a movie can be philosophically compelling too. The filmmaker can have a philosophical agenda of his or her own, and she can use the film as a sort of vehicle for working through that agenda. Really good science fiction movies often have this character. A filmmaker wants to make a philosophical point about freedom or about the nature of the self or the nature of time, and she presents us with an elaborately constructed alternative universe explicitly designed to get us to think in a certain way, usually a philosophical way about these things.
Now, a film like The Reader does both things simultaneously. It won a Dionysus Award last year. It gave us a emotionally and compelling and philosophically complex picture of a couple of human lives, but it also gave us an issue of moral luck and moral responsibility to think about.
Yeah, and I think among this year's crop of nominees, we find a mixture of all these ways for a movie to be philosophically gripping, from compelling stories of men at war, to imaginatively constructed alternative universe, to extended and deep reflections about the meaning of life. It's all there. It's all there.
And we're eager to get on with it. In a little bit, Ken and I will announce our first Dionysus Award winner. Plus, we'll hear from some very special guests.
And we want to remind you that unlike your average award show, we're eager, we invite, we seek nominations from the floor. So join the fun by suggesting a film at call 1-800-525-9917. That's 1-800-525-9917.
But first, our roving philosophical reporter, Jill Replogle, meet some people who take their cinematic philosophizing very seriously. She files this report.
Chris, who is the one who's going to be the main actor in this?
Heath Ledger.
It's Tuesday night. I'm in a cozy room in the Berkeley Hills with a group of men and women shooting the breeze about the latest movies. Someone pops open a bottle of wine and people shuffle by a long table set with brie and chunks of baguette, peeled shrimp, and homemade chocolate chip cookies.
You either just love it because you love Terry Gilliam and it's just wacky and bizarre.
Sounds like a typical get-together among friends, right? They're actually students. This is a class, and they're getting credit for it. You might be even more surprised by the guy who teaches this class, which is called the Cinematic Salon. His name is Michael Morris, and he's a Dominican friar.
I really like Hitchcock.
Morris teaches art and theology, with an emphasis on film, at the Dominican School of Philosophy and Theology. The school is part of the Graduate Theological Union, a group of seminaries and grad schools offering everything from a master's degree in art and religion to a doctorate in Buddhist studies. So just how does Morris's film class fit into the curriculum?
Religion and the cinema are the two conservators of myth in modern society. And they tell the stories that are important to our souls. And just as religion is studied, I think cinema should be studied as well.
Morris teaches two classes on film at the Dominican School. One analyzes the history of religion and film.
We start off with, of course, Old Testament epics.
Let my people go.
Jesus movies.
One of you is about to betray me.
Movies about priests and nuns.
The power of Christ compels you.
But then we move into other more enveloping subjects like war and peace, utopia, the social gospel, and horror. Oh yes, horror is one of the great bastions of supernaturalism. Anything can happen in a horror film, and you just don't question it. You take it on faith.
Morris's other class, the one with the cheese and baguettes, involves sitting around a table and picking apart the latest blockbuster. Tonight's target? The Blind Side.
Michael Orr, an extremely large African-American teenager, has had a bad past in Memphis. His mother has struggled with drug addiction, which contributed to him being forcibly taken away from her when he was 7 years old.
Orr gets taken in by a rich white woman from Memphis, played by Sandra Bullock, and becomes a college football star, eventually going on to play for the NFL.
This team is your family, Michael. When you look at him, you think of me, how you have my back. Are you going to protect the family, Michael?
Yes, ma'am.
This is a true story for those of you who aren't familiar with Orr's career. Now, a football movie might not seem like the most obvious choice for a theological discussion, but Morris' students find plenty to talk about.
The kid has dissociative disorder. Are we going to talk about that? Like, every time he encounters a scary situation, he closes his eyes and, like, counts to three and forgets about it afterwards?
Money matters to me.
Ryan Parker is a veteran of Morris' film class.
Avatar has made over $1 billion. And for a lot of people, it's not an indicator of how good a film is, and I agree, I get that from an aesthetic standpoint. But the amount of people that are seeing that, what that does to maybe a collective social conscience, and ought to be dissected from as many standpoints or viewpoints as possible, theological, philosophical, you know, what are people making of this?
So often we go to the movie for escapism, but then also we go for someone to reach out to.
Jill Browning. She's a first-year master's student of art and religion.
Whether that be the person sitting next to you or the person on the screen. So stories of redemption and salvation will never, ever grow old because people continue to need to hear that. And that's not always in the form of theology.
For Philosophy Talk, I'm Jill Replogle.
I'm John Perry, and with me is Ken Taylor.
And we're talking about the most philosophically interesting movies of 2009. We'd love, love to hear your nominations. Which movies from last year did you find most compelling when viewed through a philosophical lens? And if you can't think of any recent movies that were particularly good, reach back to the past and give us an older suggestion.
Join the fun. Help us find the winners of the 2009 Dionysus Awards. Give us a call at 1-800-525-9917. 1-800-525-9917. Or email us at comments@philosophytalk.org. And we've started a live blog, too, so you can exchange views with folks from all over the world. Go to our blog at theblog.philosophytalk.org.
So, John, there were two pretty amazing science fiction movies released last year. One was Avatar, and the other was District 9. Avatar, I think it was an amazing piece of movie making. It was totally immersive and totally engaging. My 12-year-old son, when he came out of that movie, said, "Dad, I've never seen a movie like that." And he was right. There's never been a movie quite like that. District 9 was also gripping, and they were both about kind of the same thing. Man's inhumanity to the alien other. I think one of them should win an award. I don't think both should, but one should. Which one do you think? I mean, what do you think?
Well,
do you agree that one of them should win an award?
Oh yeah, absolutely. Both terrific movies. To me, they remind me of the difference between Hume and Kant. And you may say, why is that? Well, Hume thought that the basis of ethics was a natural sympathy and emotion that we had for other people. And you can imagine that this could be extended to individuals like the Na'vi, who, though quite different from us, are still enough like us. But Kant thought the basis of ethics was the rational community, the community of reasoners, and these crustaceans were capable of reason. So it's not that I think Hume looks like a Na'vi and Kant looks like a prawn, but I think it's interesting.
I think you're right. I mean, the Na'vi were other, but not so radically other from us. The prawns in District 9 are so radically other that sympathy, this feeling of identification, just isn't there. I mean, they don't look anything like, they look like large shrimp. And, you know, you go, ah. But it raises this profound question. And unfortunately, I think in that movie, it doesn't give a profound answer. It leaves us with a puzzle. Can we find moral community with this alien other?
I mean, in Avatar, there really aren't moral dilemmas. There's good guys and bad guys. In District 9, it does seem to me to make us more, I mean, question what we would do. Which side would we come down on? In Avatar, we all think we'd be with the people who fight for the Na'vi, but it's not so clear in District 9.
Yeah, and you know, it's kind of weird. They have a similar kind of ending, because in both a human becomes the other, right? But in District 9, it's kind of unsettling because, well, I won't give away the ending, but the sequel could be very dark in District 9. In Avatar, the sequel is about the triumph of good over bad. I mean, there's such clear good and evil, such a clear, neat resolution in Avatar, I think. And I think District 9 is more troubling. I mean, do you agree with that?
Yeah, I agree. And I think they'll both have sequels, so that if we make the wrong decision this year, we can reverse it in a couple of years.
And both are very fine pieces. I think Avatar as a movie is just an amazing movie. And I think the future of movies lies somewhere that way. But you know, I wasn't as compelled by the movie as I was by District 9. So look, it's time to fish or cut bait here.
The Dionysus Award for the most compelling portrayal of man's inhumanity to crustaceans is District 9.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. It's the second annual Dionysus Award Show. We're giving awards to the philosophically richest movies of 2009.
Coming up, we'll take more listener nominations, and Ken and I will announce the Dionysus Award winners in the category of most hellacious depiction of war and most profound riddle of existence. Join us by calling toll-free at 1-800-525-9917. That's 1-800-525-9917. Or email us at comments@philosophytalk.org.
Dionysus Awards winners, plus nominations from the floor via your calls and emails and blog entries when Philosophy Talk continues.
Toto, I have a feeling we're not in Kansas anymore.
Frankly, my dear, I don't give a damn.
Open the pod bay doors, pal.
I'm sorry, Dave. I'm afraid I can't do that.
I'm going to make him an offer again with you.
You talking to me?
What you got to say?
You talking to me?
Play one of them.
What you got to say?
Play as time goes by.
Life was like a box of chocolates.
Here's Johnny.
I am John Perry. This is Philosophy Talk, and we're giving out the Dionysus Awards for the best philosophical films of 2009.
And I'm Ken Taylor. What philosophically interesting movies have you seen this past year? If nothing from 2009 appeals to you, have you got any favorites from the recent or maybe not so recent past? Be prepared, though, to tell us why you find your nominees so compelling. We'll be talking about our own picks in just a little bit, and we'd love to know if you agree. Love to know if you disagree, too. The number is 1-800-525-9917. That's 1-800-525-9917. Or email us at comments@philosophytalk.org.
Before we get to this year's Dionysus Award for the most profound riddle of existence, we've got a caller from Chicago who blogs about movies at ferdionfilms.com. That's Marilyn Ferdinand. Marilyn, welcome to Philosophy Talk.
Thank you very much for having me.
So we're pleased to have you, Marilyn. So tell us, what's your favorite philosophical movie of 2009?
Well, it's not just my favorite philosophical movie, but it's also, I think, the best screenplay of 2009. That would be Robert Siegel's Big Fan. Siegel wrote The Wrestler from last year,
right,
with Mickey Rourke's big comeback. And this was his directorial debut. And this film is a lot deeper than it looks on the surface.
Well, it's about set up the premise for those of this movie for those who haven't seen it. When you
say
it's a lot deeper on the surface, I know what you're referring to.
Yeah, this is a film that talks about a fellow named Paul Ofiero, and he is a diehard New York Giants football fan. He has a dead-end job working at a parking garage, and he lives at home with his mother. He's in his 30s, unmarried, and doesn't seem to have a girlfriend or boyfriend. And he basically lives to cheer on the Giants.
Yeah.
One day he spots his all-time favorite player, a linebacker named Quantrell Bishop, and follows him to a strip joint where he goes up and introduces himself. An altercation ensues, and he's beaten into a coma by Quantrell. And the rest of the film sort of discusses how he faces this crisis of confidence, shaken beliefs, or whatever.
Now, this movie seems to me, in one way, very topical because we have all these famous athletes and who think they live by other rules from other people, right? I mean, the formerly beloved Tiger Woods, I don't think would ever beat anybody up, but he did seem to think that he had a special sense of entitlement that arose from his wealth and his fame and his great success. And this movie's partly about that, but which seems to me a socially complex issue. But is there anything philosophically gripping? I mean, that causes one to rethink assumptions and all that in this movie?
Well, what's the name of this movie again?
It's called Big Fan.
Yeah, because I didn't see it, I must admit.
So Marilyn, I saw it and I liked it, but tell me why you think it's, you know, worthy of a Dionysus Award. We're not just awarding, you know, we're not just singling out good screenplays, good acting. We're trying to single out things that make you think, that compel thought, and help you reconfigure your thinking. So how does this movie do that by your
lights? Well, I think it does it, and I'm going to quote Soren Kierkegaard on this one.
Oh, good.
He said in his journals, "The thing is to find a truth which is true for me, to find the idea for which I can live and die." And I think that's an interesting point to make about Paul. In his, I heard an interview with the actor who plays Paul, Patton Oswalt, and he said, "I think Paul's a really happy guy." And that really made me think. In my initial review of this film, I thought, well, Paul is actually the angry white man, the stereotypical angry white man. He's always scowling. He's sarcastic. He's rejecting of his family. But his family has been pushing him to have a real career, to have a real relationship, to have the life that everybody wants. And Paul says in a very pointed argument with his mother, I don't want that.
Yes, I remember. That's a powerful scene. John, you wanted to get in there.
Well, so I haven't seen this movie, but I want to force you two to make a decision. Let's say, consider the Dionysus Award for the most philosophically compelling film having something to do with professional football. We have a choice between this movie, Big Fan, and Blindside. Why should we pick this movie over Blindside?
Well, you know, I haven't seen Blindside, but this movie, I want to agree with Marilyn that this movie is in a way about authenticity and about an authentically lived human life, because everybody else thinks this guy's a loser, he's miserable, he should choose a different way of life, he should do a different path, and in the end, he says no. This is the life I want. I don't want those other things. I don't want what he has and she has. I want this.
So, Marilyn, I bet as a blogger you saw Blindside. You want to give us your verdict between the two?
Well, I did see Blindside, and Blindside, it doesn't set up any dilemmas in my opinion. It's a feel-good movie, well-executed film, but not complex at all. Basically, it tells you if you're good to people and you live your value, your Christian values, which is what Sandra Bullock did, and take care of somebody who needs taken care of, life will be good. Big Fan says, you know, Paul believes in the Giants and Quantrill with all his heart, and despite a lot of pressure, he sticks with that.
Okay, you've convinced me. If I can have a drum roll, I'll announce the winner of the most philosophically compelling movie having something to do with professional football. The Big Fan.
Marilyn, thank you so much for joining you. I'm a big fan of your blog, FerdyonFilms.com.
Thank you so much. Thank you very much. I really appreciate it. Take care.
Okay, thanks, Marilyn. John, so far, we've talked about the repression of aliens, about an obsessed fan, but what about ordinary human life and the meaning of life?
That's our next category, Ken, the most profound riddle of existence, and we've got a runaway favorite for this one. So without any further ado, the winner of the Dionysus Award in the category Most Profound Riddle of Existence goes to A Serious Man.
It's not about Danny's bar mitzvah. My boy Danny, this coming Shabbos, very joyous event, that's all fine. It's more about myself. I've had quite a bit of tsuris lately. Marital problems, professional, you name it. This is not a frivolous request. This is I've tried to be a serious man, you know? Tried to do right, be a member of the community, raise the Danny, Sarah, they both go to school, Hebrew school, a good breakfast. Well, Danny goes to Hebrew school. Sarah doesn't have time. She mostly washes her hair. Apparently, there are several steps involved, but you don't have to tell Marshak that. Just tell him I need help. Please, I need help.
The rabbi is busy.
He didn't look busy.
He's thinking.
So, John, I love this film, but why should A Serious Man win a Dionysus Award?
Well, Ken, when you break down the riddle of existence, we mean the riddle of human existence, and there's varieties of human experience, and two of the most puzzling varieties are being Jewish and growing up in the Midwest. And this combines them into one glorious film.
Yeah, this is a really glorious film. This may be not just my favorite philosophy-oriented film of the year, but my favorite film. I love this movie. And it's really profound. It's so deeply poor, what's his name?
I don't know.
Poor protagonist. he tries to see the rabbi who's going to make it all clear.
Gopnik.
He tries to see the rabbi. His wife is leaving. His kid is on drugs just before his bar mitzvah. It looks like he may be denied tenure. A guy who flunks his exam is trying to blackmail him. He may have a fatal disease. All this stuff is just thrown at him and thrown at him and thrown at him. And he keeps plugging along. And you want to ask, How can he keep going on? Why? Why? What is life for? If this is what life is, should I do this? So a Serious Man, that is a really, really fine movie. Yeah, and I think it well deserves a Dionysus Award.
And he drives home each night to this kind of slab house in the suburbs of Minneapolis on the windswept prairie with the struggling little maple tree in the front. It's just reminded me a lot of growing up in Lincoln, Nebraska.
So I think this has to be a consensus Dionysus Award winner, right? And I really recommend that. If you haven't seen this movie, go see this movie. It will change your thinking. So I want to remind our listeners, we're talking about the Dionysus Award winners for 2009. These are the most philosophically compelling movies of the year, and we'd love to have you join this discussion, and you can do so by calling 1-800-525-9917. That's 1-800-525-9917, or you can email us at comments@philosophytalk.org. And we've got a caller on the line now. I'm not sure which caller we have. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, caller. Which caller is this?
Oh, my name is Justin.
Oh, Justin. So okay. What movie did you want to talk about?
Daybreakers.
And where are you calling from, Justin?
Portland, Oregon.
Daybreakers. That's a vampire movie, right?
Correct.
I haven't seen this. I read a lot of reviews of it. It got kind of panned, and it was in the theaters for like 5 weeks, I thought.
I think that's been a little graceful. I think it was shorter than that.
Yeah. So why do you, despite all that, Justin, you think this deserves a Dionysus Award? Tell us about the movie and tell us why we should give it a Dionysus Award.
As a precursor, some of the things I'll say probably are mild spoilers, so just as a fair warning.
Okay.
But the movie's about vampires, and the world is now ran by vampires. But kind of the question that gets posed is, and previous to the storyline taking off, is a virus breaks out, and people get to choose whether or not they want to change to vampire or stay human, which I think is a very existential theme of, does one choose to face one's mortality or not? And most people choose to become vampires.
Uh-huh. They would choose immortality over a human life, eh?
Exactly.
What's the downside of being a vampire?
Well, there's a famine, and it reduces people to fairly base beings.
Wait a minute. There's a famine because they've killed off all the humans, right?
You got it.
Oh, God. What a macabre premise.
But to me, what is so philosophical in this movie, I mean, here's the context, but the cure for vampires to come back, to regain your humanity, is to face and stare into the sun. It is exposure, whole body, to the sun. And in doing so, and facing one's mortality, even when choosing immortality, you become human again. And to me, that is an immensely existential, specifically Sartrean theme that this movie does a very good job of creating a concrete example
of
what that means.
So, Justin, I see that this movie has a very rich philosophical premise. I see that. I looked at a bunch of clips and I read a bunch of reviews, but would you say this is a good movie rather than just having a good philosophical premise?
I would say it's a mediocre movie.
Okay, so that just seals it. We can't give you a Dionysus Award. We want movies that are both good movies and philosophically compelling.
We'll give you a Dionysus honorary mention for the best vampire flop in terms of philosophical content.
Okay, so there you go, Justin. You get half of a loaf, not a full loaf.
Okay, I'll get the Dionai, and that's it.
There we go.
Okay, Ken, we're getting a lot of emails. Let me just mention some. Email from Greg, who nominates No End in Sight. It is very gripping, tragic, poignant, and has enormous food for philosophical thought. There's email from Paul, who nominates Moon. Starring Sam Rockwell, the main character encounters his own clone and then realizes that he himself is a clone. As both clones come to terms with their newly discovered status, they question the purpose and authenticity of their lives. So
there are lots of suggestions. Yeah. Nominees. We'll have to think of whether we want to give those awards. So look, we've got another caller on the line with a nomination for a Dionysus Award. That's Anne in Santa Cruz. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Anne.
Hi, thank you.
So what movie do you want to tell us about?
Inglourious Basterds.
Oh, I like that movie. Tell folks a little bit about it for folks who haven't seen it.
Well, this involves spoilers, too, as the last person said that...
Well, this is an award show.
That's right.
Yeah, don't worry about it.
It involves the ultimate fantasy of revenge and catharsis in killing Hitler during World War II.
And I was just really compelled by the premise of fighting evil and cruelty with evil, or definitely the semblance of and cruelty. And at what point does the defense become more egregious than the initial assault?
Right, right. So these guys, it's an alternative universe, kind of, because I won't give away the plot, but these inglorious bastards line behind enemy lines and take out Nazis in a cruel and vicious way. And you think there's a moral dilemma here for them?
Well, as I say, I mean, are they on par with the Nazis? Are they doing good?
The Nazis are the bad guys.
Well,
can't you do anything to the bad guys?
Oh, you can do, yes, you can. But then do you become a bad guy because you're doing something to the bad guys? There's a line that the head of the bastards, so to speak, has that the Nazis have no humanity and therefore they must be destroyed, which
right.
is, of course, pretty much the Nazis' argument for everybody who's not a Nazi.
And I'll give away one spoiler. When they kill the Nazis, they scalp them. And,
oh, right.
And they
leave. Well, actually, they're dead first.
Yeah, but still, there's something weird about scalping. That's some kind of barbaric practice, don't you think?
Well, that's because the Aldo Raine character is supposed to be part Indian, so I think that's where that ties in. And Tarantino just likes over-the-top stuff, no pun intended.
Yes, Quentin Tarantino is a director. I didn't really want to go see this movie because I didn't think I'd enjoy a lighthearted movie about Nazis, but it was really quite good. And I like Tarantino. The other night on Craig Ferguson, he was explaining movie appreciation, and he said, you know, you can make up your own backstory. It doesn't have to be accurate. Everybody's got equal rights there. I thought that was a lovely thing.
Yeah, I mean, I think I agree with you. I like this movie. I think, John, it sounds like you may want to give it a Dionysus Awards. Let's see what the jury... I think the jury's kind of out on this one. There is another theme I want to talk about that's in this movie. It's revenge. I mean, this movie is about Jews doing the dirty work
right.
of taking down the Nazi regime. And I won't give away the end, but it's in a way a revenge movie.
Oh, right? Absolutely. It's an ultimate revenge movie, I would say.
Yeah. So I like this movie a lot. John seems a little on the board. So I think we're going to give you another half a loaf, right?
That's better than none.
It's a good movie. It's a much better movie, I think, than that vampire movie.
Yeah.
But it's not as philosophically rich.
Yeah, honorable mention for a really interesting movie by a great director that doesn't quite make a Dionysus Award. Inglourious Bastards.
Okay, you're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're taking a philosophical lens to the movies of 2009 for our second annual Dionysus Awards.
We've talked about a lot of different films so far, and there's still more to come. In our next segment, we're going to take more suggestions from the floor and ask you to think if there's anything we've missed or something we've gotten wrong. Number 1-800-525-9917, 1-800-525-9917.
Suggestions from the floor and so much more when Philosophy Talk continues.
You can never tell. The movie's gonna make me a big star. Cause I can play the part so well.
We're playing the part of an award show this week. I'm John Perry, and this is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Ken Taylor. It's the Dionysus Awards, and we're talking about the most philosophically compelling movies of 2009. We were just talking about the movie Inglourious Basterds, the war movie. It's a fine movie by Quentin Tarantino, but we didn't give it a Dionysus Awards. But we do have a category for war movies, right?
Yes, and we think that there's a clear winner. It trumps Inglourious Basterds. The winner for the Dionysus Award for the most hellacious depiction of war goes to... The Hurt Locker.
Yeah, this is, yeah. We don't got enough time, Sam. We don't got enough time. I gotta get these bolts off.
No. We had a minute and a half, man. We got to get out of here.
No. I'll handle this. Just go.
Look, Will, come on, man.
Look, I'm right behind you. Just go.
Sam, come on.
Sam, I got the suit. Just go. Sanborn, you have 45 seconds. You have 45 seconds, Sanborn. Leave.
You're the damn man, Will.
Go.
Everybody get back.
Go.
So, John, this is a gruesome movie. I mean, this makes the war look like hell. There's no doubt about that. But philosophically, I mean, why should we give it a Dionysus Award?
Well, for one thing, I think it does a great job depicting the psychology of the war of the warrior in war. I mean, of the person who lives for the adrenaline rush, which can't be greater than one of these bomb diffusers. And I think it does good about moral dilemmas because you have the dilemma in this picture constantly that, you know, is this person I see that looks like a normal person about to destroy me? What do I do? What risk do I take? And you get the general moral principle that in war, no good deed goes unpunished.
Well, that's definitely true. I like both those points. The point about the psychology of the warrior, and it's not as there's this main character, the bomb diffuser. There's his psychology, but there's also the other warriors. And so it represents the range of ways that a warrior psychology can be made up. These guys are all fine warriors, but one's the devil-made care, get in charge of it, get in there, do it, take every risk imaginable, right? And it's true, and it's a complicated thing about the Iraq War, is that, and this makes it so vividly visual. The complicated thing about the Iraq War is the question of who is the enemy. Right? I mean, you're immersed among these people, and some of them are on your side, some of them are indifferent, and some of them are hostiles. And how do you tell the difference? And what does that do to the warrior who has to live in this situation? And what does it do morally to the nature of the conflict? So I think you're right. I think this is a really interesting movie. So I think we agree. This is a clear winner for the Dionysus Award for the most hellacious depiction of war. But We've got another caller on the line now, John. Right? That's Tim Sika, president of the San Francisco Films Critics Circle. Tim, welcome to Philosophy Talk.
Well, thank you guys for having me. It's a pleasure being here.
Yeah. So tell us about your pick for a Dionysus Award.
It was a great year for philosophically rich movies. As you know, everything you guys have been saying. It's a great show, by the way, but. For me, one of the most enjoyable and effective movies I think I have ever seen about creativity is a movie that hardly anybody has seen. It's called Me and Orson Welles. And this film depicts specifically the creativity of Orson Welles as seen through the eyes of a young high school student who has very great aspirations himself. It's a period drama film. It's a crack coming-of-age story. It's directed by Richard Linklater. It stars Zac Efron, of all people, right, from the High School Musical.
Yeah, right.
Right? Christian Mackay, a wonderful British actor who brilliantly embodies the essence of Orson Welles and Claire Danes, and it's based on a Robert Kaplow, a wonderful historical fiction novel of the same name, and the story is set in 1937 New York. It tells of a teenager hired for a small role in what would become to be known as the legendary Orson Welles production of Julius Caesar, and I think what I love about this film so much is how it presences the whole notion of creativity in film, in theater, and this notion of reinvention, in the case of Orson Welles, the reinvention of the stage, in the case of this film, his hugely successful production of Julius Caesar, a year or so later, the reinvention of radio, which Welles did in his broadcast of War of the Worlds, and then a year later after that, the reinvention of cinema with Citizen Kane, all before Welles was 26 years of age. And it's just about art on so many levels, the art of the performance, the art of the actor. It's a film of brilliant historical detail, the look of it.
So Tim, I mean, it sounds like a great, great film, and if it's got Orson Welles, it's about Orson Welles, it's got Claire Danes in it. I don't know how I missed it. How did this slip by me?
Well, you know,
what was the deal with it?
And let me add to that I've been trying to see this movie recently, and it's not anywhere around. And it's got great. All the critics, all your compatriots that I read, love this movie.
Yeah, you know, great question. It's one of those movies. It actually sat in the can for about a year. One of those great under the radar movies that the studios did not know how to market. You know, they didn't know whether to market it to the Zac Efron crowd, people, you know, young girls coming in thinking, oh, who the heck is this Orson Welles? You know, coming to expect to see Zac Efron sing and dance. He has a little movement here and there, but it's a dramatic performance that he does really well. It's just it was a difficult movie to market, but I don't know of anybody that hasn't seen it that, you know, hasn't loved it.
Well, yeah, so like I said, I've been trying to see it. I've seen a bunch of clips from it. You can see all kinds of clips from all kinds of things online if you're willing to look at certain sites. So I've seen about maybe 40 minutes worth of this movie, whereas clips of this movie, and I got to say, I agree from the amount of it that I've seen. I agree with you. And one of the things it's also about, you mentioned the art of art theater. It's also the art of a self, the art of self-constitution. Because Orson Welles is his own artistic creation, I would say. Would you agree with that?
I think that's a really, really, really good sort of encapsulation of Orson Welles and who he was and how he walked through the world. His whole life was a performance. He was larger than life. I mean, he was so big, I think, that his problem was that the mediums that he worked in, they had a very difficult time containing that, like, volcanic energy and genius and self-confidence. I mean,
Tim, you've convinced us. We're going to give this film the Dionysus Award for the philosophically richest movie that most people missed.
There you go. Thanks so much for joining us. It's really been a pleasure having you on Philosophy.
Well, it's a pleasure being here, guys. It's a great show, and I'm glad to be on it, and I'm going to listen more often. Thank you.
Okay, thanks a lot, Tim. And we've got another caller on the line now. That's Alexa from Berlin. Is that Berlin, Germany, Alexa?
It sure is.
Oh, wow. Thanks for calling. All the way from, I think you get the prize for the furthest away caller ever. So what's your movie nomination?
I'm a big fan of KLW. I'm from San Francisco.
Wow, good.
I'm just recovering from the Berlinale, which screened about 400 films in the last 11 days.
Oh, wow. Right. That's this big, huge film festival in Berlin,
so,
right?
Yeah, this is both a plug and a nomination.
Okay.
I know this film has not yet been screened in the United States, but I want to make a plug and a promo for it. I think it deserves a great philosophy award of some kind. And maybe if enough people ask for it, it will be screened at some point in San Francisco. It's from the Czech Republic, and it's called Kawasaki's Rose. I know that doesn't sound like it has anything to do with the Czech Republic, but this is actually a family drama wrapped in a historical thriller, in a way, on a psychological level, if that makes sense.
Yeah, well, make me want to see this movie. Tell me more.
Tell me the name again. Spell out that first word. Telesaki, what was it?
Kawasaki.
Kawasaki.
Just like apostrophe S, rose, as in the flower.
Okay, make me want to see this movie.
Mm-hmm.
As a philosopher.
Okay. This is for anyone who is a fan of Milan Kundera's The Unbearable Lightness of Being.
Oh, great movie. Great novel.
It takes dealing with the past a step further. And the reason I think it has so much philosophical gravity is because it makes people stop and think about forgiveness and how they might have acted after the Soviet invasion of Czechoslovakia after the Prague Spring of 1968. This is about, it centers on a very esteemed psychiatrist who is about to get a very prestigious award called the Memory of the Nation. And a TV crew begins to film him so they can get some nice shots of his everyday life to put together for this big award that's going to be given to him. And then they come across some files that make him look like he wasn't such a squeaky clean figure during the Soviet occupation after all. And so it involves the whole family, and I don't want to give away too much, but you start to look at his life and the choices that he made from the point of view of his wife, his daughter, the daughter's estranged husband, who actually happens to be on the TV team, and he's the one who starts to...
So let me ask you a question. So movies like this, like The Reader is a little bit like this, I think, if I'm getting you right. There are people who make choices in their past that we look back now that weren't so great choices, but the thing that makes these movies compelling when they're compelling is that you get to have to ask yourself the question, what would I have done? We all think we have such sterling character and that we'd be, if we were put to the test, we would pass it. But it turns out that even people we think have sterling characters, when put to the test, they didn't fare up so well. And these kind of movies often ask you, what would you have done? Is that the kind of movie this is?
Yes, it is. But I would be wary of thinking too hypothetically. I think it's enough of a jolt, I guess, just to pose that question to oneself. One doesn't need to necessarily answer it, but what this film does is make us have a lot more compassion for people and the kind of choices they made that we probably, at face value, would never have given a second thought. We would say, "Ugh, I would never have done something
right,
like that."
Right, exactly. But you know what? On that note, I'm going to thank you. I think we should give this a provisional Dionysus Award since it hasn't been released and we don't really know. We kind of trust you, but we got to see for ourselves.
Okay. Philosophically richest.
No, it's a provisional award.
Google the title there, or you can go to berlinale.de and you can read about about the film there on their website.
It's clearly the philosophically richest movie nominated by somebody more than 5,000 miles from San Francisco.
Okay.
So now, you know.
Well, I'm always there in spirit because I grew up there. So
okay. Well, thanks so much for calling.
To your program online, so that's what made me want to call.
Thanks so much for calling all the way from Berlin. Now we've got an email here from Dennis, who nominates A Single Man. I thought that was a great film. Dennis says it's a film that makes one think about the meaning of life, the value of it once love has passed, aging, modern threats, nuclear holocaust, etc., all in the context of the 1960s. It seems to be getting very little attention, I expect, because it's a gay-themed film. I agree with all that. I thought it was a terrific movie. Did you see it, Ken?
No, I haven't seen it, but you make me want to. You very much make me want to see it. So I hope it's still around. I mean, one of the nice things is that even after movies go away between Netflix and all this sort of stuff, you can still see them. But, you know, sometimes these great movies come and go so quickly. There was a film last year, Schenectady, New York. It just disappeared suddenly, but it was a great movie, too.
Well, maybe we can get a couple more emails in favor of this before the show ends. We'll give it an award.
Yeah, we've got lots of emails, lots of things on our blog that we haven't had a chance to get to, but we'll compile them all and put them all together in a list, and we'll see. We got time, I think, for one last caller, and welcome to Philosophy Talk. Who are you?
Oh, hi, I'm Renice, and I just wanted to nominate Push.
Push. Tell us about Push, quickly.
Dakota Fanning and teaching children to be psychically connected as weapons.
Wow, that's a mouthful. I'm not quite sure what that all amounts to, but we'll give that one some thought. But on that note, Renice, thank you for joining us. And you know, this has been a great conversation. Like I said, we'll compile all the nominations. We'll put them on our webpage and on our blog. There's lots of emails, lots of blog entries. But this conversation continues. It's already started on our blog. Go to our blog, theblog.philosophytalk.org, where our motto is Cogito Ergo Blogger, or to our Facebook page.
And you can download podcasts of our program from our website as well. For the final word, we're going to turn to the winner of the award for the fastest philosophy on the radio. Ian Scholes, the 60-second philosopher.
Ian Scholes, how do still photographs become motion? For a long time, the illusion of movies was explained by a supposed biological flaw called persistence of vision. An image lingers in the retina for a millisecond after we see it. The persistence of this image, when paired with another succeeding image and another, the theory goes, fools us into thinking we're watching real movement. This may be why movies are treated with strange ambivalence. We go to movies to escape, to chill, to let the movie wash over us. A movie is chewing gum for the eyes. It's a diversion. It's eye candy. It's a bit of fluff. It's a frothy bit of rom-com. It's the feel-good hit of this or any other season. It's an action-packed thrill ride. The movies have an arsenal of manipulative techniques at their disposal. Cute movie stars take off their clothes. Jump cuts, stirring music, montage, close-ups, special effects, computer-generated robots having fist fights in abandoned warehouses. We, like sheep, sit in the dark with our butter-flavored cold popcorn, our persistent vision acted upon by wizards of deception. Many movie makers resist this and strive to find a kind of authenticity amid the delusion. Director Lars von Trier formed Dogme 95, which issued a kind of manifesto insisting that all films must be done on location with no props or set brought in. Louis Buñuel never used music or sound to tell us how to watch a scene. Even Mr. Rogers on his television program would not allow the camera to cut from one person to another. He thought it would be confusing and alarming to his young viewers. Marxist, feminist, structuralist, and otherist experimentalists talk about the dialectic of film, the tension between the materialist flatness and tricks of the screen and the alleged reality it represents. The illusion of realism must be destroyed. The trouble is, persistence of vision is a myth. Now think about it. If an image is retained on your retina for a millisecond and the next one appears, you don't get an illusion of movement. You get one after image piling on top of another, kind of like Marcel Duchamp's New Descending a Staircase. What is actually going on with movies, scientists now believe, is a phenomenon called short-range apparent motion. It doesn't have the same ring as persistence of vision, but it's more accurate. Perception doesn't happen in the eye. The eye is not a camera. Perception happens in the brain. Our brains make the movie. We are not passive and conned viewers of an illusion, in other words, but active participants in its creation. The movies began as a penny arcade novelty and then rather alarmingly became an entertainment behemoth with movie theaters that rivaled cathedrals. Just as quickly, in the historical scheme of things, movie theaters devolved into multiplexes as bored teenagers replaced the uniformed ushers of the movie's golden years and butter flavoring replaced butter. Many of us seldom venture into theaters at all anymore. We rented tapes, then DVDs, then even opted to own movies and show them in entertainment systems bigger than actual movie screens. Besides owning movies, we can download them or stream them from the internet. We can watch movies on a telephone. Why? I don't know. With YouTube, the line between audience and movie maker is increasingly blurred. We make videos, post them, watch the videos of others, leave snarky, semi-literate comments about them, and everybody's happy watching movies that aren't making anybody any money. Where it will all end is anybody's guess, but we sure aren't passive consumers anymore. We're hyperactive consumers of crap we created ourselves. Take that, Jean-Luc. I gotta go.
Ian Shows, the only man who can solve a philosophical problem in 60 seconds.
Philosophy Talk is a presentation of Ben Minella Productions and the trustees of Leland Stanford Junior University, copyright 2010.
Our executive producer is David Demarest.
Our production coordinator is Devin Strolovich. Our directors of research are Daniel Elstein and Ben Hirsch. Lael Weiss is our webmaster.
Also thanks to Chris Hoff, Merle Kessler, Corey Goldman, and Mark Stone.
Support for Philosophy Talk comes from various groups at Stanford University, the Friends of Philosophy Talk, and the members of KALW San Francisco, where our program originates.
The views expressed or misexpressed on this program do not necessarily represent the opinions of Stanford University or of our other funders.
The conversation continues on our website, philosophytalk.org. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Thank you for listening.
And thank you for thinking.